त्वमेव माता च पिता त्वमेव त्वमेव बन्धु च सखा त्वमेव त्वमेव विद्या द्रविणां त्वमेव त्वमेव सर्वं मम देवदेव. I am so happy to be here with you. I would like to talk sort of globally, because it may cause some of you to wonder how these Americans have come to be so involved in this path of yoga. I'll tell you a little bit about my own story. It's not terribly interesting, perhaps, but it shows you how the longing in the human heart is everywhere the same. There is no difference between people in India and America. Basically, all of us are seeking the same thing. In fact, as Swami Shankaracharya said, all of us are seeking Satchitananda. All of us want perfect, absolute bliss. And we seek it in the wrong way. Well, I did not know these teachings. I was born in Romania. I'm not Romanian. My father and mother were American. But my father was an executive in Esso and was an oil geologist. So I lived there for 13 years. I went to school in Switzerland. I grew up speaking several languages, Romanian, German, French, English. I have lived in America only since just before the beginning of World War II. That was when I was 13. And I wanted very much to know what life is all about. And I could not find answers. I sought it through science. I thought of becoming an astronomer. And I tried to make my own lens, my own mirror for a telescope. Just at the end, it fell off and cracked, and I just got discouraged. But I went on from there to seek maybe the answer to what we're looking for, all of us, in politics, in various things, not in business, I have to admit, because business was one thing that I had no interest in. When I was 16 years old, my father said he wanted to buy me a tuxedo. You know what a tuxedo is? It's what you wear when you go to posh affairs. I said, "Dad, don't bother. I will never wear it. In fact, I will never earn enough money to pay income tax." That proved to be a true prophecy. I was not interested in that aspect of life, but I desperately wanted to know truth. I wanted to know what life is all about, and I came to decide that truth cannot be a matter of just objective facts, because it doesn't matter to me now. You know, when I was 9 years old in school in England, mind you, this is how far science has taken us in this century, in this period of time, which of course I'm talking of the 20th century. A teacher came to me and he said, "You know, they have found that that all the stars that we see are just one star system. There may be as many as two or possibly three other star systems." That shows you how far we have come since then. Now they know that there are 100 billion of them. And finally, who's counting? It is an incredibly vast universe, but really, as far as you and I are concerned, if it's a billion, 100 billion, or two or three, or even just one, it doesn't make any difference to us. We're still stuck on this mud ball of a planet. And so I decided that that cannot be the truth that I want. I want a truth that is more relevant in human terms. And I thought that maybe a political system will do it, until I gradually began to realize that systems don't do it. We have to change ourselves. We have to find inspiration in ourselves. And so then I began to study. I studied the piano and thought maybe through music people wanted me to become a singer. And I thought, what is there to sing? There's nothing that was worth singing in the West that I knew of. The classical songs of the Western culture are all just the same old builds that you find everywhere. And so then I thought to become a playwright. And I realized, because my desire in being a playwright was to help people to know the truth, I realized I didn't know the truth. So what was the use of it? And I did not know whether there was a God or not. I did not feel God in the church that I went to. I did not feel the truth that I wanted in religion. And although I kept talking about God, I realized that the God I was seeking was something different. And I remember some years ago I was in Australia, and a man came up to me after a lecture of mine, and he said to me, "You know, I'm an atheist, and I hear you talking about God a lot. What can you say to me that would be relevant?" And I paused a second and I said, "Well, why don't you think of God as the highest potential you can imagine for yourself?" And he paused a moment in shock. And he said, "Well, I can live with that." And indeed, that is what I was coming to myself when I was seeking truth. Until finally, I remember going out. I wanted, at that time, I was studying playwriting and how to become a playwright before I realized I didn't know the truth. And I went out one night in the dark. And I thought, what if God exists? What can he be? I thought, well, he can't be a man sitting on a cloud. He can't be a policeman sort of waiting for us to make a mistake so he can throw us down into hell or the dungeon of hell. Why am I conscious? How can I ask this question? It has to be because he is conscious. And if he is conscious, he has to be consciousness, because my consciousness can only have come from his consciousness. And therefore, I must be an expression of his consciousness. And if this is so, then the more I can express of his consciousness, the more fulfilled I will be. Whereas the more I cut myself off from that consciousness, whether by materialism or by drinking or by other things that dull the mind, the less I have of it. And therefore, the goal of life is to find more consciousness. The goal of life is to find God. And that's the only purpose of life. And I decided that was what I would give my life to. And I thought to become, I did not know anything about India. And I thought of going maybe to South America, because one can live cheaply there. And I thought of going out into a jungle and spending my life meditating. And I thought, if I can find a little bit of peace of mind, then I will be satisfied. At least it'll be better than what I have now, which is no peace of mind. It was at this time, and mind you, God does take an interest in our lives, and he does guide our lives. And this was one first proof that I, demonstration that I had of this fact. My father had been sent to Cairo, Egypt, to head up an exploration firm to find oil there. And in fact, they did eventually find oil where he said they would. But my mother was to join him. The day that I put her on the ship to go to Egypt, mind you, they did not fly with planes in those days, so it was a ship. The very day I left her on the ship, I went up, stay uptown New York, and I discovered Autobiography of a Yogi. And I was so amazed. The first thing I saw was this picture, and it was so attractive. Then I opened up the book, and it said, "Dedicated to Luther Burbank, an American saint." I said, "Oh, there cannot be any American saints." And so I put the book down, and I bought another book. Somebody had told me in Charleston, South Carolina, about the Bhagavad Gita. And I don't know why, but it had a deep meaning to me, the sound of this name. And so I bought a Gita then. I read this. Then I came in town a few days later and I thought, well, I must. What about that autobiography of a yogi? And I thought, oh, I've read too much. I'm too intellectual. I'm trying to save my money. I want to go to South America. I should stop reading and I should stop spending my money buying books. And so I'm not going to do it. And I found my body being forced to go left to Fifth Avenue, where that bookstore was. And I thought, well, I did not make this decision. There's something else happening. I became quite excited, and I bought that book. And interestingly enough, I met a friend from high school right as I had bought this book. He was in that shop, and he was talking to me in glowing terms about all the wonderful success he would have in television and so on, which was a new thing in those days. And it hadn't yet come out on the market. And I just, the more he was talking about this, the more I was clutching this book as if I had found a friend. And I read that book really between laughter and tears. Laughter of joy, tears of even greater joy. And I took the next bus across the country. America's a big country. It's three times as big as India. You have four times as many people, but we have three times as much land. And 4 days and four nights. And I met Yogananda. And the first words I addressed to him were words that I had never dreamed I would ever utter to anybody. I was a young, arrogant American intellectual. The first words I said were, "I want to be your disciple." And I have never, in these nearly 60 years, had any change of heart. I found finally, I know when I was 5 years old, my mother wanted to teach me, because we were in Romania and my mother tongue was English. There were no schools in Romania. So she tried to teach me. And the first thing I did was, at 5 years old, rather cheeky, I sort of reared back like this and I said, "And how do you know? You're not a teacher, you're just a mother." Well, so she sent to England and got some teacher to come. But the truth is, that was pretty presumptuous of me to say that. But the other side of it was that I always wanted to feel that I wanted to learn from somebody who knew what he was talking about. And I never met anybody who knew what he was talking about. I met a lot of professors, but finally, I had 6 months to go in college. I thought, this is a waste of time. I do not want it. I want truth. They don't talk about truth. They talk about footnotes. And you're not allowed even to publish a book that doesn't have 50 footnotes. There's one book I looked at, 500 pages long, 2,500 footnotes. In Greek, in French, in Latin, without translating them. And I thought, well, no. None of these people know what I want. But when I met Yogananda, I knew he had what I wanted. And if anybody said anything to me that sounded strange or preposterous, my first question was, did he say so? If they said yes, then okay, I accepted it. That book is the greatest book I have ever read, and I imagine all of you have read it. It is a book that is so full of love for God. And I guess this is the thing that worried me most. I was very intellectual. I had read a great deal. I spoke 9 languages. I knew so much, and I didn't know anything. And I thought, what is life all about? And then I realized that I was no longer happy. But I remembered when I was a child, I had been happy. And I thought, what's wrong? Intellectuality will not give me what I want. How can I find it? But with him, I understood love is the way. Heart quality is the way. We must open up our hearts to truth. And indeed, I had always been this way, that if I felt something in my heart, I could be sure. But reason, I used to play a game with myself when I was a child. I would invent all sorts of reasons for things that I knew were ridiculous, just for the fun of showing how reason can be misused. But the heart knows. And when I met him, I knew from my heart that it was he. I lived with him for 3.5 years. And it was the most extraordinary experience I have ever had. A man of deep wisdom, a man of deep love. You know, you look into people's eyes and you see ego there. You see self-definition there. In his eyes, I did not see any self-definition. I saw no ego. I saw deep love, but impersonal in the sense that he wanted nothing from me All he wanted to do was give to me what I was ready to accept. But he understood what life is and what we need to do. And he was so broad-hearted, not just broad-minded. He could relate to anybody. He could relate in their language. It was astonishing when he talked with doctors, for example. He'd never studied medicine. But he could use their terminology and talk with us as if he himself was a doctor. He could talk on any subject. I used to wonder, because he did not seem at all intellectual, but he understood everything from inside. I used to marvel, because I studied a lot of Western theology and so on. There have been many schools of thought in Western theology, just as there are in Indian philosophy. And I was amazed to see how his teachings answered all these different trends without studying them. He just knew. His life was one that God had brought to the world for a particular purpose. He used to say to me, "You have a great work to do." And I never accepted that as a compliment. I accepted it as a duty. Obviously, I had certain things that he wanted me to do. He told me I would have to write. I said, "Sir, haven't you written all the books you could that could possibly be written, that need to be written?" He said, "Don't say that. Much more is needed." And I discovered over the years that indeed what he had brought, you know, when Swami Ramatirtha went to America back at the end of the 19th century, he said, "Someday you Americans will take this yoga science and make it practical and bring it back to my people." And Yogananda, living in the West, made this teaching practical, not just yoga science, but the whole teaching around yoga. He made it practical to show how you can bring these teachings into daily life and how they can change daily life. And so I have written many books, always in his name and with his inspiration, because I don't think I'm anything. I was very amused when Kirit Mehta, who's the owner of Asta, said to me one time, I said to him rather, I am nobody. And he said, "Well, nobody's perfect, that means you're perfect." I said, "Well, okay, but I'm certainly nobody." The thing is that with his inspiration, I have been able to do a few things that are perhaps worthwhile. And one of them has been to take his teachings and show how in every phase of life, they are useful, they are practical, they apply. In education, I wrote a book called Education for Life, based on his principles. And I showed how children can be taught not just how to prepare for a job, but how to prepare for becoming human beings, mature human beings who use their qualities in good ways and dharmic ways. And many people, many parents worry, "Well, but if you teach these children this, then where will their academics go?" Well, now we have been about 40 years into our education experiment. Next year will be the 40th anniversary of the founding of Ananda Community. And what we have learned is that our children, when they graduate, they get the best marks on nationwide exams. They become leaders in their campus when they go to college. They become leaders in their business world or whatever it is. They do better scholastically than other children because they learn how to concentrate. They learn how to be peaceful. And in the meantime, you find these children who are not bullying each other the way so many children do, but who are kind to each other, who help each other. They're trained to be human beings, and they grow up with that. Well, I think this is very important. I think nowadays, I see in the papers again and again, these children committing suicide because they can't stand the pressure. And people want them to get ahead scholastically. Our children get ahead scholastically without having to beat their brains out because they know how to concentrate and absorb. You know, how we react is a very important part of knowledge. I remember when I was in college, I admit I got sick of it and I began to start skipping classes. And I remember a course I took in Greek. Well, Greek is a useful language for somebody who knows English because it's one of the bases of English. In fact, English is a wonderful language because it has so many roots. Somebody from India once said, I don't know that you can call it a language. We have Greek, Latin, French, German, Scandinavian, all the indigenous countries of England and Ireland, the Celtic and the Picts and the Scots and so on. All of these sort of mixed into English as we speak it today. But it's a very rich language. It has more than four times as many words as any other language in the world. And there's so many subtle ways you can express English. Anyway, in my studies, I got tired of Greek and I stopped going to class and I never did any assignments. And as the semester was coming to an end, we were given things to translate in the class, and I could recognize a few words like and the. That was just about sum it up, I think. And the professor would say, well, there are, of course, some people in this class who might as well not come to this exam. And everybody looked at me and laughed. Well, I said, no, I'm going to pass this exam. And a week before the exam, I sat down and decided, now I'm going to study. Oh, it was so far from my interest. I was seeking truth. I didn't want Greek. And so I thought, well, I'll study twice as long tomorrow night. And the next night came again. Finally, I realized, my God, tomorrow morning I've got my exam and I haven't studied at all. And I hit upon a very interesting solution. I told myself, you're Greek. But you know, when I thought of myself as a Greek, there was nothing to learn. It was just a matter of absorbing. So for 2 hours, I just studied Greek, and it was all none of this tendency of the mind to push away what you're trying to bring in. It was all just absorbing. After an hour, 2 hours, I couldn't do any more. Now, I know some of you are students. I don't necessarily recommend this system to you. But nonetheless, it can be a part of your answer. Tune yourself into the subject that you want. You know, I took that exam the next day. There were only two people who passed it, and I was one of them. It was a difficult exam, but somehow I just knew. You can know so much without having to learn everything intellectually. And in our schools, we teach people to tune in to the subject. I have written something like 400 pieces of music. You heard a little bit of it here earlier. And I did not study. I took a course one semester of music composition, but I never went to class, so you can't really say I studied. But when I decided that this would be one way to share with people, share truths with people, then suddenly it all just came to me. I thought I was driving in a car, and I thought, well, maybe I could write my own songs. And all of a sudden, God gave me this song. And I stopped at a milkshake stand and wrote it down on a paper napkin, and that was the beginning of my, what you might call, my music career. But the truth is that I tuned into it and I heard it. You can do this. I'm not nobody special. I'm nobody. But the less you think of yourself as somebody, the more you can actually do things. He can do things through you. And this is what I want to bring to you today. How we can become instruments for a higher power. How we can understand that our self-definitions are our delusions. Now, you've all seen, and I do not want to denigrate the wonderful experience that India has had in winning the cricket match, and you've seen people jumping up with joy. The trouble is you jump, but you always have to come down to earth, don't you? And so people jump and jump, and after a while, not only do they come down to earth, but a week from now, people will talk about the cricket matches, and they'll talk about next year. They'll forget about this year. And every success you have in life, you think, oh, wonderful, but there's always an aftermath. You always come down to earth. And when you rejoice over anything, this is a simple fact of nature, that you simply have to endure its opposite. And I remember, because of course I come back here into Indian philosophy, Dvaita, but I remember one time, usually I'm very even-minded, but I had always dreamed of going around the country in a motorhome, teaching people and singing and so on. And we got a motorhome for a tour around America. And I was so delighted with this. I just sat back and laughed and laughed. And I knew that for this, abandoning myself to the joy of having done this, which I had wanted to do for so many years, I would have to pay a penalty. And I just thought, well, okay, I'll pay the penalty. That same night, you know, these things when the ego principle is not strong, the results come much sooner. And so that same night, I was in that motorhome, and somebody was at the steering wheel, and he put it in what he thought was neutral, but it wasn't, to go back to the refrigerator to get something. And the motorhome was moving very slowly without our being able to tell that it was moving, but it was in a parking lot, and there was a big market, supermarket, with a big concrete wall at the end, and it hit that thing very hard, threw me off onto the floor, and I broke a finger, and I laughed and laughed. I thought, this is a perfect example. For every joy in life, you will have to suffer an opposite. For every plus, you will have to have a minus. For every victory, there will have to be a disappointment. This is the nature of this world. This is what I learned from my guru. Now, how does it happen? How can there be that? Well, I was asking the question, what is God? God produced everything. Sequence of thinking that I went through in Charleston, South Carolina, was really a discovery of Advaita, of Vedanta. Everything is consciousness. There cannot be anything but consciousness. God created everything out of that consciousness. He did not, like a carpenter, have wood that he could saw and make into what he wanted. The only thing he could do was dream it. Now, how can he dream what seems to be a very solid world? The seat that you're in, I hope it doesn't become too solid, but you know it's solid enough to hold you at least. How does this happen? You know, it's a very interesting thing, and now we can talk about things that even 150 years ago they could not talk about. Matter is energy. Science declares this. Matter is energy in a rate of vibration. But you and I, if we're not scientists, may say, well, how is this possible? All right, think of two things. One, the propeller on an airplane. When it moves fast enough, it looks solid, doesn't it? When a tuning fork moves back and forth, it looks as if the space between those two movements is solid. In other words, vibration gives the illusion of solidity. And in this universe, there are billions and trillions of different vibrations which make it seem as if we're living in a solid world, but it is not. And this is something that all the great masters have said. Everything is vibration. But it's more than vibration. Where did that energy come from that was able to move into vibration? It came from will. And my guru invented, created, I should say, discovered, if you want to put it that way, a system of energization exercises, which are wonderful and keep your body filled with energy. But his basic principle is that the greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. To give you an example of this, you can be working let's say that you have a party and you have lots of dishes in the sink, and it's late at night and everybody goes and you're just too tired to look at those dishes. And you get up in the morning and you think, oh, I can't face that. And you go to work and you come back and you're very tired and you look at those dishes and you know you ought to do them, but oh, I can only go to bed. And you start to lie down on your bed when the telephone rings. And an old friend of yours is in town who you have not seen for many years. And he says, I'm only here one night. Let's go out on the town. What do you do? Do you say, I'm sorry, I'm too tired? No. Suddenly you have all the energy you want. You go out and you stay out late and have a good time with him and come back and you're full of energy. And the next morning you're full of energy. Energy is what energy is what fills the body with strength. And will is what fills the body with energy. Will is what created and manifested the astral world of energy, which through that manifested this material universe. And behind that will was consciousness. And behind that consciousness is the Brahman, the infinite spirit. All this has come out of that infinite one. Now, how did God create it? By vibration. There has to be a movement. He set his thoughts in motion. And with that motion, everything began to gain a certain amount of appearance of reality. The threefold aspect of Om is actually not the Trinity that the Christians talk about. Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva are just the vibrations of Om, the vibration that it takes to bring everything into manifestation, the vibration it takes to keep it in manifestation, the vibration that it takes to go back and dissolve into Brahman again. And if you hear these three aspects of Om in meditation, you can actually hear them. It sounds, I mean, it doesn't sound like this, but you can use a car, an automobile, as a very good example. Because when the automobile starts, it goes, isn't it? Listen to your motorcycles, you'll certainly hear that. Then when they're going, and then they stop. And so it is that everything has a higher vibration to get started. Then it goes into an ordinary vibration. And then in the end, there's that deep Shiva vibration that dissolves everything back. When you die, you will hear an aspect of Om that will be a manifestation of that level of the astral world to which you go afterwards. And some people will hear a very base vibration. They go the other place, let's say. But those who meditate will go to the higher place and they'll hear a vibration that is very soothing. In fact, when you hear that sound, it's not like listening to beautiful music. The most beautiful song can become tiring in time. But when you hear Om, it vibrates with the very strings of your own being. And you know, as soon as you hear it, you could listen to it for all eternity and never get tired. But the Christian Trinity is something deeper than that. The Christian Trinity is Om Tat Sat, the Spirit, the Om which has created all manifestation, and then the Tat is the reflection of Spirit in each individual atom. Because God, who is without vibration, has to be present everywhere. Creation can't get away from him. So reflected in every atom is the Kutastha Chaitanya, which is the Tat aspect of that great Trinity. And what we need to do is understand that Christ, Krishna, the great avatars and masters in India and in other great religions, all of them have attained that same state. There can be no one who is greater or less great than another. Because when they reach that state, they all attain oneness with Brahman. There can be nothing greater than that. So all the fighting in religion is a great mistake. But I have to say one thing, that one of the causes of quarreling in religion is the organized religion. Organized religion is a very lower kind of religion. And the wonderful thing about Hinduism specifically is that it is totally disorganized. And as a result, you don't have any priests who can decide that somebody has to act this way. You don't have a pope who tells you that you must be this way. Everybody can be himself. He can seek that truth inside And some people come along and speak truths which are absolutely foolish. And I have to say, in all honesty, and I don't want to offend anybody, but when the teachings of Rajneesh came out in America, I told our bookstores, don't print them. This is not true teaching. The truth has to be very on a very different level from that. Well, I won't go into that tonight, but I think it's very important to understand that the truth is not getting involved in Maya, but disinvolving yourself from it. And Dvaita is that teaching which means that for every single thing in the universe, there must be an opposite. For every movement, there has to be an opposite. I went to a ballet in New York some years ago, and it was a very unsatisfactory experience, because whoever had this got the theory that creativity should begin, just should be a constant process. You can't do that. It was very dissatisfying to see these dancers moving this way and then a little more and then a little more. No, everything has to come back to its center. We are center in ourselves. Everything has to go to that center. And so it is that if you find success in this world, you will find failure. If you find victory, you will have defeat. If you find joy, you will find sorrow. The answer is to not be involved in the play of Maya, but to withdraw into your own self. After God knows how many lives, you know, it takes 5 to 8 million lives, the Shastras tell us, to reach the human level. And mankind has the capacity to make mistakes, as animals do not have. And so man can go up or down as he chooses. And so men sometimes become animals again. Usually, once you have reached this level of humanity, you only fall for one life. But if you keep on erring, you can go down and down and down. You can reach the level of a germ. It's a scary thing. You know, in the Gita, it speaks about when God manifests this universe, he throws all these beings out into outward manifestation again. That means that people who finish with it all one day of Brahma, they go into a night of Brahma in a quiescent state, but when they come out, they have to go back to their same state that they were on. And who knows? This is a frightening thing. How many days of Brahma we have to go through? Because man's capacity for delusion is infinite. If this woman doesn't do it, maybe she will do it. Well, how many women are there to do it for you? How many men are there to satisfy your need for a mate? Infinite. And how many ways are there of succeeding and failing in life? Infinite. Man has the infinite capacity for blundering. And it's only after a certain time that he begins to see that it's just not working. This world begins to develop for him a certain, as my guru put it, anguishing monotony. Most people still think, oh yes, well, it didn't work that way, I'll find another way, I'll find another way, I'll find another way. And you look at people's faces in the city, and you see that they cannot be the result of their genes. Too many different states of consciousness. They don't come from genes. This is the great delusion of modern science. They think matter is the reality, and consciousness is produced by matter. They think that if they can make a computer sophisticated enough, it will finally be conscious and self-conscious. And yet, what could be simpler and more obviously self-conscious than a worm? You prick a worm with a little stick and it'll squirm away. It's obviously conscious and it's obviously self-conscious. You don't need to have a thing to produce consciousness, because consciousness already is producing the thing. Everything is a part of that consciousness. J.C. Bose in Calcutta discovered that even the metals have consciousness. They react in the same way. And so I've written a book called Out of the Labyrinth, in which I showed, in discussing Darwinian evolution, I showed how Jesse Bosch, how Bonhoeffer in Germany and other people in America and elsewhere have demonstrated that the reflexes of metals and of rocks even are the same as yours and mine, and that has brought biologists to two possible alternatives. One, that nothing is conscious. Second, everything is conscious. It takes consciousness to wonder if I'm conscious. Obviously we're conscious. And so the answer is everything has come from that consciousness. Now, in that, we understand that sooner or later, we have tried to seek it outside, but this is like controlling something with a stick outside yourself. It's here that you have to find happiness. And you know, a mother in a famine, sooner or later, if there's no food, she will have to feed herself, even because then only can she keep feeding her baby. On an aircraft, if there's a sudden loss of oxygen, they say put it on your own mask, the mask on your own face first, and then help others. Because if you're unconscious, you can't help them. Sooner or later, everything comes back to having to be yourself and do yourself. Sooner or later, everybody goes back into himself and thinks, what am I here for? Why am I here? Now, this is what people come to eventually. They think, why am I in this world? And they see that nothing has given them what they look for. I discovered this. I grew up in a well-to-do home, and all my friends were well-to-do and came from the same home. And the dream that everybody offered to me was having a nice home, having a nice wife, having a nice job, having a nice income and nice children. To me, there was nothing closer to hell than that. I thought, what a compromise. There's no joy in it. And I thought, there's just got to be something else. I grew up in what was at that time the largest company in the world. And I saw that these were all nice people, but they didn't have joy. No, when I met my guru, I remember one time he was talking about a job that had to be done on the driveway, filling some potholes. And I was not involved. That wasn't my job at the time. And so I was just sort of meditating, and I felt so much joy coming from him. I thought, that's not who he is, thinking about work. That joy, that's what I'm here for. Now, we need that joy. Somebody said to me not long ago, do I need a guru? I said, absolutely not. You don't need a guru at all. But if you come to the point where you know that you want God, then you need a guru. Not until then. I read in the Times of India two or three years ago, people don't need gurus now. Now they can go to a bookstore, they can go to the library, they can read all the books they need. That's not what a guru gives you. You know, in the Christian Bible, it says that as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God. This is what the guru gives you. He gives you power to become that consciousness. The ego cannot do it. The ego is, well, let me put it this way. We, with Copernicus and then later on with all the other scientists, we have discovered how vast this universe is, that it's not this little planet, and it's not even the sun, which they believed up until the end of the 19th century. It's not even our galaxy. There's no center in this universe. And then, in the teachings of the Shastras and in my guru's autobiography of a yogi, he pointed out that the divine consciousness is center everywhere, circumference nowhere. This is a staggering concept. God didn't create people the way we create statues. He had to create it from inside out. Everything begins from a little point. Human beings begin from the union of the sperm and the ovum, and they subdivide and finally become a human being. And the center of the ego is here in the medulla, That's why when people are proud, arrogant, they look down their noses, but really they're not looking down their noses. There's a tension that builds up in the back of the neck, which pulls their head back. This is the center of ego, and that is why the Namaskar is a universal thing, even though they use the principle here in India more. But in all countries, to bow to someone is to offer him honor and praise and respect. But what it does is a bow releases this tension here. It's an automatic thing. We're all much wiser than we know. We understand that we need to offer ourselves. And this begins with this inner understanding. The real self is centered here in the heart. That's why in Autobiography of a Yogi, Yogananda, in the chapter on an experience in cosmic consciousness, when he was in Samadhi, he said, I cognize the center of this empyrean as a point of intuitive perception in my heart. This is your egoic center. And from this you understand what is and what is not. Without chitta, you cannot have real understanding. This is why Patanjali says, Yogas chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the neutralization of the vrittis, but you could also say waves. Vrittis is more literal, of chitta or feeling. Books will tell you that it's consciousness. No, it's that aspect of consciousness which is feeling. There are, as you know from your study of the Shastras, four aspects of consciousness. Mon, buddhi, ahankar, chitta. One time my guru, when he was a young man, he went to the Maharaja of Kashim Bazar and asked him if he would help him to give more land for his school. And the Maharaja thought, well, let me see what this young man knows about the scriptures if he's going to teach religion. And so when Yogananda went into this room, there were many pundits there all set to challenge him. He said, I could see they were ready for a theological bullfight. And so he said, okay, we all have studied things, but if we know them only with our minds, our brains, our intellect, we don't understand. He said, the scriptures say that these four states, mon, buddhi, ahankar, chitta, have their corresponding location in the body. Now, this is not in the scriptures, but can you tell me what those corresponding places are? Well, of course, they were without hope because they couldn't think of anything in the Shastras that told them. So Yogananda said, this is where the mon is. Buddhi, between the eyebrows, ahankar at the back of the spray, is in the medulla oblongata, chitta in the heart. And mon is, my guru's guru, Swami Sri Yukteswar, used this illustration. He said, look at a mirror. If you see reflected in the mirror a horse, the mon will see that it's a horse, it'll see that it's something, but it won't be able to say what it is. The intellect comes in and says, oh, that's a horse. Then ahankar comes in and says, oh, that's my horse. Even so, you haven't yet got caught in Maya. Maya comes in when you begin to say, oh, I'm so happy to see my horse. So when desire, when enjoyment, when feelings in the heart get involved, that's when you begin plunged in Maya. The secret for getting out of Maya is to calm the feelings of the heart. I remember I met a sadhu in Puri 50 years ago. I used to live in India before. And he told me you should not enjoy anything. I said, what, not even a beautiful sunset? No, nothing. I thought, what a dry path. My guru taught us something very different and much more beautiful. He said, enjoy everything with the joy of God. Don't think I am enjoying, but God is enjoying through me. And with that, we can enjoy all things. And I saw this in him. He was no gloomy Gus, as we say in America. He was full of joy. He would come out onto the lecture platform with his long hair streaming behind him. I used to have long hair, but let's face it, when you have so little hair, it would look ridiculous. And the first thing he would say to people is, how is everybody awake and ready? He would want to talk to an audience that were full of life and willing to listen and with joy. Well, this is what we need to understand. We need to understand how we can address citta in such a way that we achieve calmness in our vrittis. That is what Kriya Yoga is all about, but it's also what yoga and daily life is all about. In the beginning, God is center everywhere, circumference nowhere. You are centered in your ego. That's the center from which he was able to create you. And you, being an ego, see other people as other egos. But it's all God. You don't have any reality except as a manifestation of him. And what you do is, because divine vision is circumference nowhere, everything is one. God is everywhere. But science can never teach you that, because science can only give you outwardly the center of a mole of an atom, a single electron. But that doesn't make you there. You have to go to your own center. And this center, we have created, unfortunately, a circumference. Baggage of self-definitions. I am a man, I am a woman, I am Indian, I am an American, I am Italian, I'm rich, I'm poor, I'm educated, I'm... Self-definitions go on and on. They don't stop. And you carry around this heavy baggage as you go from life to life. And you can see that little ego even in little children. That's why they bully each other. They think, I'm better. And that's why people jump up and down. India's better than others. Well, you know, next year somebody else will win. And I don't want to denigrate it, as I said. But I have to give my own experience of cricket. And I hope you will forgive me. I went to school in England for 2 years, and we had to play cricket. And to me, it was the most boring possible game. They would throw this ball, and somebody would hit it or miss it, and everybody. And then go back to drinking tea while they bowled the ball. It went on for days and days. I used to lie down in the outfield, waiting for somebody to shout that the ball was coming my way, then I'd get up and run after it. But I'm afraid it seemed to me not very interesting, and baseball the same. But the real interesting thing is to understand this great adventure that we're living. You don't know what a great adventure it is. You have been put into this body, into this world, into this ego, to understand who you are, where you have come from, and why you are here. And you can get little glimpses of it. And I gave you one little hint of it a few minutes ago when I said that the first thing you need to understand is that every time you've had success and you go back into yourself, you're disappointed, you go back into yourself. You know, a few years ago I was in a hospital in Delhi. I had double pneumonia and I was almost unconscious. And a doctor came into the room. And, you know, doctors usually don't say what this one said. Here I was almost unconscious, and the first thing he said to me was, "Sir, can you help me?" I said, "I'll try." I could hardly speak. He said, "I have a son in college in Canada. I have so many duties in this world. And how is it possible to succeed in this world, to pay your bills and everything, and always be completely dharmic?" I said to him, "I have found in my life that by following dharma, I have always succeeded." Well, unfortunately, I was not a glowing testimonial for success, lying there practically unconscious in that hospital bed. And I don't think he believed me. But then I wrote a course called Material Success Through Yoga Principles. And I showed how with dharma, it is true. There's a power behind you that works to work with you if you let it. It's sort of like if you have a drum, if you have something on a skin extended over two pieces of wood, no sound will come, just a little tapping. But you put it over a big drum sound, it'll sound long and hard. Ananda Moyi Ma used to say to people, "I am just like a drum. As you beat me, so I sound." And this is the truth. I stayed many times with her, and it was really a very great blessing for me. But the thing is that when you understand that, You understand that there is something behind you, like a musical instrument. You heard the guitar being played. If he'd only had those wires, it wouldn't have made any sound, but they had the box of the sounding board of the guitar beneath it. And so, for example, one time we were starting Ananda Village. This was back 40 years ago. And we didn't have much money. My parents didn't give me any money for this. Nobody gave me money. I had to earn it. I had to go out and teach classes. And fortunately, I discovered that if you don't charge anything for classes, people don't practice. So I charged a certain amount, not much, but enough to make them take it seriously. And with that, I gradually earned the money that I needed to buy land and start a community. And one young man came to me one day and he said, well, I have inherited a lot of money and I want to know, what should I do? Should I go to India or should I stay here in Ananda Village? Well, I was not even tempted to ask him to stay in Ananda Village if it wasn't right for him, but I asked him, how much did you inherit? Because I wanted to know if he had enough money to go to India. I figured if he was asking such a question, he didn't feel drawn to Ananda Village, so I wasn't going to tell him that. So he said $200,000. In those days, this was 1969, it was comparable to about $1 million today. And I wasn't even tempted, as I said, go to India. That's where you can find what you're looking for. And I never regretted that. We had a forest fire in 1976, and it destroyed 21 out of our 22 homes, and we had no money. How were we going to rebuild? Just at this time, neighbors telephoned that this forest fire had also wiped out their homes, and they had discovered that the fire had been started by a faulty spark arrestor on a vehicle belonging to the county. So they said, we can sue the county and get all the money we want. I thought, no, that is not dharmic. I will not sue. And I wrote to the supervisors and I said, we will not be suing you. We were the biggest losers. But they were lamenting 10 years later over what they had lost in that fire. We went out this next day and cheerfully began to clean up all the broken, burned up leaves and trees and brims and everything else and rebuilt. And we're still there. God has always helped us, and always because we have been dharmic. There is something working that you don't know about. I came to Delhi and to India in 1972 on a visit. I had been away from India for 10 years at that time. And I wanted to go to Calcutta. I speak better Bengali than Hindi. I can't say that I'm very proficient in either, but I speak some. And there was a Dr. Mishra that I knew who lived in Bhubaneswar. And I had wanted to see him because he had gone back to India, but I didn't have his address. So I landed in Dumdum Airport in Calcutta. And I was thinking, what a pity I don't know how to find my friend, because Bhubaneswar is not that far from Calcutta. And I didn't know what to do. People were supposed to meet me at the airport, and there was nobody there. They had encountered a traffic jam, I learned later. And so I didn't know what to do. Well, when people find themselves in this position, they rush to the nearest telephone and try to find out what's happening. I just thought, well, Divine Mother is taking care of me. She'll decide. Just as I thought that, I was just calmly waiting for her to do something. Somebody stopped right in front of me, had just come off a plane. And he said, what is your good name? I told him. He said, oh, I've been longing to meet you. I have been seeing your photographs in an album of a friend of mine, Dr. Mishra. I said, oh, and I've been wanting to meet Dr. Mishra, and can you give me his address? He said, you don't need his address. I've come to Calcutta appropriately to see him because he is staying in Calcutta right now. So you see what would have happened if I had run and done the usual things? By letting God handle it, he handled it in the perfect way. And so it is that you will see, and I have seen this in my life again and again, an autobiography of a yogi is full of this kind of example. When you offer your life to God, you don't have to become a sadhu. You don't have to live in the Himalaya or the Nilgiris or wherever people go from down here. Just live in God wherever you are. You can have that consciousness in your home. And this is one of the things that my guru wanted and was very strong. I remember at a garden party that he was giving in Beverly Hills, of all places, outside Los Angeles. Beverly Hills is a place with rich people, movie stars, and so on. And a garden party was not the sort of thing where normally people would talk the way he did, but he talked the way God wanted him to talk. And he started talking with the greatest power I have ever heard. He said, "Thousands of youths must go north, south, east, west, everywhere to spread this concept of world brotherhood colonies." It makes sense. If you want to know God, why work in an office where nobody else wants God, where they're gossiping against each other, where they are competing with each other to get promotion? Why not live with devotees? I swore that day that I would launch his concept. I would build the first community, and I have. And it's also because I had it ingrained in me. When I was 15, I thought of starting a community. And I got all my friends excited about it until they discovered that I was serious. Then they all left it. But I was serious. And I have discovered, because it is not an easy thing to start a community. But now that one has been started, it's easier to start others. After the first one, we have about 1,000 acres there. Lots of land and many people. We've started other communities. Some of them are in the cities. Some of them are out in the country. But we find that in these communities, people live at peace. You never hear people shouting angrily at others. You never hear people insulting people. They're all kind. And you know how it is in the villages. When somebody makes a mistake, everybody's gossiping against him. Here they all try to help him. And when somebody goes to the hospital, they all try to help him. When somebody gets married, they give them money so they can go on a honeymoon and settle down happily. Everybody is helping everybody else. I tell you, it's the only reasonable way to live. If you are a devotee, if you're a sadhak, I don't say sadhu, but you can be a sadhu in family life too, if your first goal is God. Why? This is what Babaji said to Lahiri Mahashai, that you have been born into this body so that you can show householders that they too can find God. And at Ananda villages, we have people who are householders, people who are children brought up in that community. But the wonderful thing is when those children grow up, most of them join the community. Most of them, when they have to work outside, they have leading positions in the world. This is something I want to propose here in India, and I am thinking quite seriously of moving to this area from Delhi, because I think this is where we can do something. And I want very much to get land here and to start a community and to get all of those of you who want to live a spiritual life and to follow our path, because it doesn't work to have people on different paths in one community. We found this out because people on another path would say, "Oh, Krishna doesn't like onions." Well, we do like onions. So you don't have all this sectarian squabbling when people are all following one way. But it's such a broad way that it embraces everything and everybody. So anyway, if you want to help us in this, please do, because I really believe in this. And I'm no longer young. I'm getting old. I'm 81 years old. And who knows when I will check out. I'm eager to. But I'm also willing to work as long as my guru wants me to, because I want so much. When I came to my guru those 4 nights and 4 days across the country, I thought, "Oh, I want this for myself." But I've made this way that when I find a good thing, I want everybody to know it. And so I also thought, this is too good to be kept a secret. And it was a wonderful thing that I had to do it on my own, because I wanted this to spread. And I have done this through books that I could not have written in that organization. I have done this in so many ways that I had to do it on my own. And now I understand what my guru meant when he said, "You have a great work to do." He said to me one day, apart from St. Lin, that's the name of Rajarshi Janakanandi, he called him before, every man has disappointed me, and you mustn't disappoint me. And he said it with such intensity, I thought, no, I will not. But I don't think he meant, I know he didn't mean all his men disciples had disappointed him in spiritual ways. They were all there for what they could get. And it's masculine energy that is needed to get out there and do things. And this is what he had me do. I am grateful. I have done quite a lot in my life. I've written 90 books. I've written over 400 pieces of music. I've taken color slides to show different states of consciousness. And I have done lots of things, but I think the most important thing I have done is get people to understand that the goal of life is God. Now, let's get back to Kriya Yoga again. When those people from the cricket match jump up and down, what are they doing? They are expressing something that everybody knows, but they don't know it consciously. We are all much wiser than we understand, than we realize. There is a certain upward movement when you feel good and a downward movement when you feel bad. Everybody knows this. When you feel happy, you sit up straight. You look up. Everything about you has a lifting tendency. And when you feel badly, you slump, you look down, you feel heavy. These are all truths. And there is something inside yourself. Everything that you're looking for is inside you, not outside. You are that which you want. It's in you. There's a story in the Puranas, maybe, or some old poem or something, of the musk deer, who at a certain season secretes in a pouch in its navel the fragrance of musk. And it wonders, where is this beautiful fragrance coming from? And sometimes in its anxiety, looking everywhere, it will leap off the high crags and go dive down to its death below. And the hunter comes and takes that musk fragrance and sells it for a very costly price in the marketplace. And this, the poet was saying, oh musk deer, if you had only understood that what you were looking for is inside yourself. You think, oh, this wonderful ad, the town is littered with ads. You'll find your happiness if you get this, if you do this. None of it is going to work. I can tell you from my own experience, it won't work. One thing will work. I've seen my friends who grew up and thought these things would give them happiness. They're sort of dead. Jesus Christ said, let the dead bury their dead. Most people are dead because they have no joy in their lives. They're sort of stumbling along until the undertaker comes to get them or the whoever. We have to understand that our joy is inside. And where is it? Whenever you feel joy in yourself, there's a rising sensation in the spine. Now, this is where Kriya Yoga comes in. By rotating currents of energy around the spine, by lifting it up through Pirda and down through Pingala, you raise it up toward the Kutastha and lower it in the spine, in Pingala, and withdraw more and more deeply into yourself. This is what it's all about. Now, in daily life, what you need to do is, when you find something that excites you, feel that movement inside and understand, discriminate. This is where I'm being happy, not there. And bit by bit, you will come to see that when you feel disappointed, you're withdrawing into yourself. So feel that energy going deeper and deeper. You will see that in daily life, in mixing with people, if you enjoy this world with God's joy within you, if you respond to the things in this world with the inner consciousness, and your reactive power is not outside, so that you're not saying, oh, how exciting or how disappointing, but just feeling it inside, you will see that everything can become wonderful. So that even when you see tragedy or disappointment, and I know somebody, excuse me, I'm going to sit down. Would somebody bring my chair over? Not because my legs are tired, but it's hurting my shoulder for some reason. So, thank you.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. You can hear me? Now, where were we? When you can respond inside yourself, what's the matter? Oh, that's all right, don't worry about it. Then you will see that even when tragedy comes, I've had somebody said to me once, oh, you can write happy songs, you have never suffered. No, that's not true. I have suffered, and it's because I have suffered that I have a right to write happy songs, because I have learned that when I am in myself, nothing touches me. There was a great period of suffering I went through because my own Guru Bhais threw me out, not understanding my purpose, and they thought I was just self-ambitious, but I was not. I wanted to reach people, and they didn't understand these things. But it was a great suffering for me. And yet, I came to find that inside I had never lost that joy. Inside yourself, in the midst of tragedy, in the midst of suffering, if you will not just weep your heart out outwardly, but just go within yourself, you will see that the more you suffer, the more there is joy. The more you rejoice outside, the more there is joy. You can keep feeding that joy inside yourself. And you can reach the point where, whether people treat you well or not well, I got a letter from somebody recently who criticized me for all sorts of things. And I wrote back and I said, well, you don't know me at all, and that you can find so many things to say against me, suggest to my mind that if you could get to know me a little bit, you'd have many more things to say against me. Let them talk, it doesn't matter. This world can say everything it wants, and the more successful you are, you can be sure the more enemies you will have. It just is a way of life. That's a part of Maya. Don't get excited by anything, but remember that God is always here. In Kriya Yoga, it's of all yogas the most central, because it deals in the spine, and raising that energy in the spine, finally bringing it into the Sushumna, and there raising it up. Finally, all that you are looking for, we will find there. You know, there's a very interesting thing, the Mahabharata. It's not just a wonderful epic and a rousing good story. It's a very deep allegory. And one thing in that allegory is when Arjuna wins Draupadi and he comes home, before the mother sees what he has won, he says, look what I have won, mother. And she says, be sure to share it with all your brothers. Remember that? And so Draupadi has to marry all five of the Pandavas. And you may think, but polyandry is not something they do in India. They do it in Tibet, but not in India. What is this? One story of polyandry? They have some polygamy, but polyandry is almost unheard of. What does it really mean? Draupadi stands for Kundalini. And Kundalini has to unite with every chakra. And the Pandava chakras unite with the chakras of the spine. The lowest chakra is Sahadev, Muladhara. And the next higher, Sahadev. That is the Swadhisthan. No, am I right on that? No, Swadhisthan, that's right. Manipur chakra is here. That's Arjuna, fiery energy. Bhima, he's Vayu, he's air. This is the air chakra, the Anahat chakra. And Yudhisthira is the throat chakra, the Vishuddha chakra, which is expansive energy and calmness. So Yudhisthira is always very calm. And the two lowest, which are the most materialistic, they had a different mother. But you see that Kundalini has to unite with all those five before it can reach this chakra here, the Kutastha, and then finally with Sahasrara. And so all these teachings of yoga are implicit. In fact, outside you will see my book, I hope, called The Essence of the Bhagavad Gita Explained by Paramahansa Yogananda. That's a very interesting book in itself, because I was with him when he dictated that book, and I was with him editing it. But when I was not in the organization, it was impossible for me to get that manuscript. And I did not like what they did with that book. I said, this is not what he taught. It's not the way he taught. And I wanted so much to express it the way I remembered him teaching it. And I remember a dream I had in which I said to him, but how can I get that book when I can't get to their archives? And he said to me in the dream, don't overlook the possibility of a skylight. A skylight is the thing in the roof. And that's what happened to me. When I began to sit down and try to write what I remembered, suddenly I found I could remember everything. And in less than 2 months, I wrote that whole book. But the first chapter, I did not write. And so I've done another one, which we will put out in a small version of just the slokas of the Gita. And it shows how every one of those warriors in chapter one of the Bhagavad Gita, every one of them is a spiritual quality, either to lift you upward or take you down. The real battle of Kurukshetra is Dharmakshetra, the battle between that within you which wants to lift you and that part of you which wants to take you down. You yourself are a kingdom, and you have millions of qualities within yourself. Some of them are latent, some of them are obvious. But that's why when Arjuna finds that he has to kill his own relatives, these lower qualities, passion, greed, anger, all the lower qualities that are in man, they're a part of your own family of consciousness. And Arjuna says, as every devotee says when he's new on the path, well, when he realizes he has to get rid of these things that are in him, how can I get rid of my ego? How can I get rid of my attachments? How can I get rid of my desires? It's not so easy. This again is why you need a guru. Because in the presence of the guru, you absorb his consciousness. The ego cannot get out of Maya by itself. That's why Bhishma, who represents ego, he has the power not to die until he offers himself up to death. And so on the battlefield, there he is lying, riddled with arrows, and still conscious. In fact, he gives a beautiful lecture on the duties of a king. But then at the end, he has to give himself up. You finally will have to say, God, I don't want this little ego. I want to merge in you. Drona, in the battle between the two, he's the guru of the Pandavas and the Kauravas. But when it comes to the field of Kurukshetra, the Dharmakshetra, and the war internally, the power of habit and samskar sides on the negative side. Because habit, it can make you meditate. If you meditate regularly, the habit will help you go. But what really gives your positive side its power is not from habit, but superconscious inspiration. The more you tune in, and this is why I wanted to talk today about Kriya Yoga in daily life. Because in daily life, you can draw on your higher self, and you can ask God for guidance. You can ask him for inspiration. Not one note of any song that I have written came from my wanting it this way or that way. Always I said, well, God, what do you want? And always the answer came. Sometimes it came like that. You can get the answers to any most mundane problem. Maybe in business, maybe with your neighbors or wife or husband, maybe you're having tensions or whatever it might be. You will see that if you calm your heart and go within, answers are there. You yourself are the whole universe. When you can find the center within yourself, that center that's everywhere, once you reach that center, you go into samadhi. You discover that truth which became all these centers. You discover that you are God. What is a Jivanmukta? A Jivanmukta, you know, it's like a field of ice on a big lake. Now, down here in Pune, you don't see ice, but where it's cold, you know it exists. And thousands of people on a big lake that has deep ice could not break through that ice. But right where you are standing, you could break through the ice with a drill. And so it is right where you are right now. You can break through that ice of Maya in yourself. That's why it says in the Bhagavad Gita that even the worst of sinners, if he steadfastly meditates on me, quickly comes to me. Who's the worst of sinners? You have to say he must be a Shudra. But even he can. There's no such thing as You have to wait all that time. You don't have to. If you seriously meditate, you can drill at this one spot. A Jivan Mukta is one who has drilled through and discovered and merged in that water of that water underneath the ice. And from that, the Jivan Mukta has to look back over all his incarnations. And you can do it in two ways. You can meditate and see that it was God who was that pirate or that businessman or that housewife or all the different incarnations you have been through. And in even one incarnation, you can see and vision these different things and realize it was God acting in that way. God acted in everything. And when you understand that, you release it. And there's no more ego identification with it. And so bit by bit, you can do this. A Jivan Mukta is not yet free, because he still has this, but he's still in Nirvikalpa Samadhi. And so he's one with God. And really, he is not less than the greatest saint, because in that he's still one with God, but he still has this baggage of the past that he needs to get rid of. I said to my guru, can't you just say I'm free? And he says, yes, you can. But many saints don't want to, because it's an excuse for them to come back into this world and to help other people. And so most of the saints in Autobiography of a Yogi were not siddhas. They were not paramuktas. They were jivan muktas. That's what my guru told me. But when you become liberated from all your past, then you become a paramukta. And he told me about one who he had met, whom he had met, who was a disciple of Ramana Maharshi, and his name was, in Paul Brunton's book, it is called Sri Rama Yogi, but he was actually known in his village as, he was known as Yogi Ramaya, but in his book, in his own village, he was called as Sri Rama Yogi. Anyway, I got to spend 4 days with him. And I said to him, but you have so much to give, why don't you have any more disciples? His answer was beautiful. He said, God has done what he wants to do with this body. You see, the great work that my guru did, the great work that some great avatars have done in this world, they don't have to do that work. It's because God wants them to do it. And he wants it through their desireless desire to help other people. And that's why my guru said, as long as any one stray brother stays by the wayside, I will come back again and again. And as I look at our line of gurus, my guru said that Lahiri Mahashaya was Raja Janaka. These gurus were great masters in India's past. Babaji was Krishna. Yogananda himself was Arjuna. And as I have studied his writings and worked with editing in them, I have come to feel very strongly and very deeply that these gurus have been coming for a long time to this planet. What is an avatar? It's when you merge back into God, that you're an ascended master, you've left all karma, you're a completely liberated person, you go into oneness with God. Ramakrishna had a beautiful story to tell about that. He said these three villagers went out from their village and they came to a high wall. They'd never seen this high wall before, and they said, well, what is this? And they thought, well, let's somehow get one of us to the top, then he can tell us what's on the other side. So they got a stump, and somebody got onto his shoulder, and the other got onto his shoulder, and he got to the top of the wall, and he looked down, and he clapped his hands joyfully and jumped down on the other side, and the other two were waiting and waiting and waiting. Finally, they thought, what a liar. He said he'd come back, and he didn't. And so they figured, well, let's see if we can somehow get one of the two of us up to the top. And so, well, this is where they found the stump. And then he got up on his shoulders and he got up on the wall and he looked down. He said, oh, wonderful. He clapped his hands and jumped down. And this third one thought, my God, what is this? So he found a tree and leaned it against the wall. And he climbed up that tree and got to the top of the wall. And he saw the most beautiful garden. His only desire was to enjoy that garden forever. But just before he jumped, he thought, yes, but if I do, all those villagers will not know. And so he jumped back to go and tell those villagers. And so it is that a very few people, because when you think that you have gone maybe billions, maybe trillions of incarnations before you reach that point of freedom, where you know that that's all you want and you don't have any more karma of the past and you're finally free, almost everybody, once they reach that, they said, I've had it. But some people have this deep desire to share with other people. That is an avatar. When he comes down from that state, an avatar is not Vishnu or something. No, no. In fact, Vishnu is only, he's not a real person. He's a vibration of Om. But Ramakrishna was an avatar. Krishna was an avatar. Yogananda was an avatar. Lahiri Maharaja was an avatar. Babaji is an avatar. There are avatars who come into this world, but not because they need to do anything, but they come because they want to help us to know freedom. And they can help any number of people. That's why when Yogananda in Autobiography of a Yogi was brought as a little baby by his mother to Lahiri Maharaj, and Lahiri Maharaj said, your son will be a yogi, and as an engine, a spiritual engine, he will draw many souls to God's kingdom. This is no joke. An avatar can free as many people as come to him, whereas an ascended master can only free a few. I asked my guru, how many does he have to free? He said, 6. You have to free 6 others. You know, there was an interesting story my guru told me. It was something that his own father witnessed. When a Maharaja in that area was digging a lake, they found under the mud at the bottom of that lake 3 yogis in lotus pose in samadhi. And they did very cruel things, driving red-hot pokers into their feet to bring them back to consciousness. And they finally came back and they said, that was a great mistake that you made. And for that, you and your family will have to suffer. And that Maharaja and his whole family died very soon afterwards. But my guru said that, yes, they committed a sin because it's wrong to bring anybody out of deep meditation. But he said at the same time, the Divine Mother would not allow them to achieve freedom only selfishly for themselves. So they had to, once you've come back to your body after being absent, somebody decided they must have been there for 300 years. When you've been gone a long time, then you have to come back in another body. But when you finally reach that point, you have to free other people, because only this way can mankind benefit. So think in terms, my guru said, pray for God to reveal himself and pray that he use you as an instrument. Give me thyself that I may give thee to all. This is the highest prayer. But we, struggling as we are in this world, struggling with all the distractions and so on, we must understand who we really are. You are not who you think you are. You are that infinite self caught in a little body. And if you can once get rid of all that ego, and that's what Kriya Yoga helps you to do. It helps you to go into your inner self. And when you can attain that state, then you see that it's all He. First of all, you go into nothingness. That's nirvana. And then in that nirvana comes everything. Satchitananda. Shankaracharya was born to correct the Buddhists, not Buddha. Buddha was an avatar. But his disciples said, oh, there's no God, because he never talked about God. He wanted to talk about you. Like one disciple of my guru, who my guru scolded him and said, why don't you try to do such and such? And the disciple said, well, sir, I want to, but it's so difficult. How can I do it without your grace? My guru answered, my grace is there already. God's grace is there already. It's your grace that is lacking. We have to make the effort. That's what Buddha came to show people, that karma kanda is not enough. You have to make the effort to find that freedom in yourself. But because people thought nirvana was just nothingness, Shankaracharya came to explain that the highest state is Satchidananda. This is the goal of all life. And if you need a motive for loving everybody, understand that everybody in the world is looking for Satchidananda. And they look for it in wrong ways, and so they may become criminals and this thing and that thing. But everybody under the surface wants that. How can you not love people when you know that they want it, and you know they're not going to find it the way they are looking? But the most important thing is to understand that that is what you want. And you will not find it through the senses. You will not find it with your ego. You will find it by offering yourself up to God. And so, here are little things that you can do in daily life too. Because if somebody insults you, for example, instead of saying, "Why did you say that to me?" say, "Thank you." Be grateful for whatever they say. Offer your ego up. I had to go to a dinner one time with, there were a lot of well-known people lecturing for this thing. And it was a big conference, and I was one of them. And I was the only person who knew what he was talking about, because it was a conference on cooperative communities, and I was the only one who had started one. But I invited these people, well-known teachers, to come and have dinner in a restaurant. So I was paying the bill myself. And they were all, because I've never tried to push myself forward, they were thinking of me as nobody and talking to each other and ignoring me. I thought, what a wonderful evening. How nice to be nobody. If people ignore you, if people insult you, if people don't give you the kind of respect or honor or whatever it is that you want, what does it matter? Every time you have a little test for your ego, say how nice. I remember many years ago, I went up into the upper part of our community from where I live, and I saw these lights on in the homes, and I thought, well, I did this. A few years ago, there was nothing but darkness in this forest. Now there are lights. And I thought, do I like that thought? No, I didn't like that thought. It made me feel small. I said, no, you did it through me. And I felt free. You will find the more you can give up this ego and say, you did it. People will say, well, I write something. I remember I was giving a lecture in a church, and somebody afterwards said, oh, that was a wonderful lecture. I said, well, God is the doer. And she said, oh, really? As if, well, I knew it was a good lecture. I didn't know it was that good. Well, that isn't what I meant. I meant he does everything. And the more you can think that way, people say, well, you have to claim some credit. Why? Yes, you have to act. I remember this lecture I was giving once, and I remembered that my guru had said, let God talk through you. So I thought there were more than 100 people there. And I thought, well, he said that let God talk through me. Let me just shut up and let him talk. So I stopped talking. And I waited a minute, 2 minutes, 2 minutes of silence. If I were to stop talking right now and just stand here or sit here and say nothing, you would begin to worry that I had sort of frozen, wouldn't you? People were sort of sweating for me. And then I finally, I was perfectly calm, but then I realized God was not going to talk. I had to talk. My guru said, I will reason, I will, I will act, but guide thou my reason, will, and activity to the right path in everything. And so it is, I realized God has to do through you with your will, but always feel it's his power, it's his understanding, it's his grace, everything comes from him. The more you can do that, the more you will feel yourself free. You will feel yourself free when you feel your own pains in other people's hearts. You will feel yourself free when you see that other people, when they suffer, you are suffering through them. You will feel free when you know that this is not all your reality, that you are one with everybody. You can do this and must do this as a conscious attitude. Kriya Yoga helps you to realize this in meditation, but we must bring meditation into daily life. And so, we have to take the inner experience of Kriya Yoga, of sadhana, of bhakti and merging in God, and we have to bring it into our daily lives so that everything we do is a part of our sadhana. Well, I've talked longer than I intended to. I never prepare a talk, and so I never know where I'm going. But I would like to close my talk with two songs. And the first one was one that somebody asked me to write a song for a bass. And in the last few weeks, I found something very strange in myself, that my voice has suddenly become very deep. And so I thought I would sing this partly because it's a good song, but also partly because it's sort of fun to realize how absurdly deep a voice can go. I don't think a human being should.